glad Mark picked that passage this morning that he did in 1 Corinthians 15. I mean, it's such a great reminder, right? I mean, if Christ wasn't really resurrected, then what does the Bible call us? Fools. You got it. I mean, we're fools. I mean, you know, if there's no resurrection, there's no promise of salvation. But yet there is a resurrection. There is promise of salvation. And it is that suffering for righteousness' sake. So that's kind of the top-level quality that we see. Now, there are other ways that kind of Joseph's character reminds us of Christ, and I'll just kind of run through them here. We see this adaptability in Joseph, and certainly we saw that in Christ's life. We see a stability in that adversity didn't harden him, nor did prosperity ruin him, right? So Christ as well, adversity didn't harden him. The fact that he could remain as loving and forgiving, as gracious as he was, in the things that he went through, I think, again, we think of the Friday night service for those who were here on Good Friday, Mark profiling suffering, right? I mean, if you're going to characterize Christ's life, suffering would be one good word to kind of capture a lot of what went on in that life. So we see the suffering. We see the resilience of never complaining or compromising. We see the faithfulness that that you mentioned. And then also the granddaddy, which is the forgiveness, right? So I think of Joseph, I think of really these two things, his suffering for righteousness' sake, and I think of his forgiving spirit, right? What's that famous little line that we end up in chapter 50 with, right? Yeah, that's all very good. Everybody heard that really, really well. You need to belt it out. Go ahead, belt it out.
You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good.
You got it. That's right. Exactly right. Okay? So it's amazing. Can you imagine that? I mean, think about that. You know, and think about Christ himself, right? All of that he suffered, but, you know, God meant it for good. So, you know, I was thinking about the Good Friday service, and I had my things messed up. Sometimes I think through and script the prayers when I'm on praying. Sometimes I don't. When I feel like I'm rambling, I tend to script it. So I thought I was opening on Friday, and I'd open it up, and I was going to ask the question in my prayer, why do we call it Good Friday? But I found out I was closing. So much for scripting it. But nevertheless, it is kind of odd when you think about it, really, right? Why do we call it Good Friday? What's good about Friday? Well, the answer to that is everything is good about Friday, right? Because God completed his salvation program by taking Christ to the cross. And then ultimately, some 3 days later, raising him from the dead. So it is a story of goodness, but God's goodness in a way that we can't really even relate to in that sense, okay? So we see those characteristics, and we see that forgiving nature in the process. Then we looked at some ways that we recall Joseph prefiguring of Christ's life. So think of some ways in Joseph's life. What were some of the things about Joseph's life that paralleled things that we saw in Christ's life? Can you think of some? Yeah. Went to Egypt. Yeah, that's a good one. I didn't have that one. They both went down to Egypt. That's right. No question. What else? They both came out of Egypt, right? Of course, one in a box of bones, but...
Kind of a stretch, but like when his brothers threw him into the ditch, and then he came out, so...
Yeah, resurrection, okay. That's
kind of a little bit
of a stretch, but that's okay. Okay. What else?
Falsely accused.
Yeah. Right. Falsely accused. That's a good one. I don't think I had that one. I like that one. Falsely accused, right?
Tempted.
What's that?
Tempted.
Tempted, yeah. You know, the just suffering for the unjust and so forth. So a couple things. They both experienced envy and hatred in the family, right? So experiencing, paralleling the religious leaders, and even Christ for a time, right? You know, his own brothers and sisters, his own siblings rejected him, but that changed over time. Secondly, the idea of being sold out for a small amount of money, 20 shekels in the case of of Joseph, and then 30 for Christ, Judas' betrayal of Christ. The rejected becomes the redeemer, right? So here we have the rejected one, and he becomes the redeemer. And then last, God's redirecting man's evil, as we talked about a minute ago, for his good, resulting in the salvation of many. And we see this kind of playing itself out both generally and specifically. So In Joseph's case, generally he fed millions through this feast, but particularly it was to preserve the what was to become the nation, the family. And then Christ generally died for sin, okay, but particularly for the elect, right? So we see kind of this general, you know, work, but then a particular focus within that work. Now, one more thing. There are also aspects of prefiguring that we can trace back to both Abraham and Isaac as well. So in what way would you say, kind of at a broad level, thinking of the Godhead in general, in what way might you say that Abraham prefigures, you know, some things that we saw in the salvation story?
Sacrificing of his son.
Absolutely right. Okay, God's love and giving up his only begotten son. Okay, he was prepared to sacrifice his son. Exactly right. What about Isaac? What do we see in him?
He was a sacrifice.
Yeah. Okay, very good. He was the willing sacrifice. Remember when we went through that, we talked about the fact that he didn't resist. You know, he submitted to his father, tying him up and placing him. At that point in life, there was no doubt that Isaac was strong enough and fast enough to get away if that's what he had chosen to do. But he didn't. He was the willing sacrifice. And then we kind of see this all come together in Joseph, picturing a number of things, right? So Joseph was the favored son, and he was sent by his father to seek his brethren. In this case, remember, he was sent out twice to check on his brothers. Well, Christ, obviously, the favored son sent by his father. He was the innocent son betrayed by his brethren. Okay, similar parallels there in Joseph's life. And then finally, he was the rejected son who became the rescuer of his brethren, right? So we see this amazing kind of prefiguring. So there are a lot of parallels, okay? Again, I won't go as far as to say a type, but we see kind of the setting up or the prefiguring of the redemptive plan as we're coming through. If you remember when we even started this whole book, which I surely can't remember that, I said that basically the seed form of every core doctrine of our faith we find in Genesis. So it's a book of beginnings in every way, not only the creation, but in God's, you know, kingdom program, if you would, in terms of how he is going to accomplish things. Okay, so many implications we can draw from his life, but two that kind of strike me in particular. The first is that one godly man can make a worldwide impact when he trusts and submits to Christ. Right? So you really can. I mean, so anytime you're ever thinking, well, what can I do? What can I accomplish for the kingdom? You know, what am I doing? Well, the fact of it is, you can accomplish a lot. And a lot of what you do, what did Mark say today, was there was the trusting, but what was the final part of salvation? There was the understanding, the trusting, and the yielding, right? So, you know, the submission is just another way to say yielded. Are you genuinely yielded to God's will? Are you genuinely yielded to what he may bring into your life and where he may direct you? And the more yielded you are, frankly, the more he can use you, right? The more you resist him, the less he can use you in the process. The second one is the importance of rejecting bitterness, right? So Joseph had every reason and every potential justification to be bitter, did he not? I mean, it seems like every time he turned around. Now, he did some foolish things, and we also see how God is preparing him through this process. But yet, you know, he was generally innocent in what he did, and he suffered and he suffered and he suffered, and then finally we see how God uses him, you know, for the process after that. Okay? So the final chapters of Genesis then unfold like this. This was the structure. In Genesis 37, we have from preferred, kind of the preferred son, to being put out. In Genesis 38, we see this parenthetical. Remember, Judah marries Tamar. Okay, what seems kind of odd, because if you read the end of 37 and you read the start of 39, you could just take 38 out and it would look like it followed. Well, it really was this issue of entanglements. And I think it's the thing that we're given to show why God moves the family, right? He just brought them back to the land. That's where they're supposed to be. Why is he now taking them out? Well, he needs to protect them from entanglements as they grow and become stronger and bigger. And so he does that by sequestering them, if you will, into Goshen, okay? In these chapters 39 to 41, which we'll get into today in 41, we see him go from Potiphar, right? So he was sold into Potiphar's house, had a position of privilege. then got betrayed by Potiphar's wife, sent to prison, and then we're going to see him go from the prison to the palace here in chapter 41. So, you know, in a relatively short period of time, a lot of down, 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 but then this ultimate kind of, if you will, exaltation in a human sense to the position in the palace. 42 to 45 then is the account of how God gets the family down to Goshen, right? So how he uses the events of the famine and the need for food to bring the family back together and back to Goshen, and then their family reunion in chapter 46. Now, as we get past here, you then see the prosperity and posterity in Goshen. So as they begin to grow and the family grows, you see Joseph getting his particular portion in chapter 48. Then in chapter 49 and most of chapter 50, we get to Jacob's final blessing. So it does come back to Jacob as the patriarch. We're going to get a pretty amazing messianic prophecy when we get to chapter 49. And then finally, we have this kind of magnanimous pardon that I talk about that closes out the book, right? What does Joseph say? The brothers are all upset. You know, they're all worrying. You know, Jacob dies. Oh, no, the kid's gonna get us now. And then we get this amazing statement of, you know, God, you meant it for evil. God meant it for good. It's not for me to judge you. And we see him provide for the family. Okay? So that's kind of how the final set weighs out, which means we're kind of getting to the end in sight here. We might actually finish Genesis before any of us go home to the Lord, which would be really nice. Okay? But if you do go home to the Lord, you're probably going to get a more accurate story when you get there. So I'll be happy for you if you do. And we will celebrate that in your memorial service. Okay, so that's where we are. All righty, so now kind of we had gone through chapter 40. It had ended with the confirmation, if you remember, of Joseph's interpretations, right? The cupbearer was indeed lifted back up and restored to his position. What happened to the baker? And he got hung, okay, just as he said in the process. And Joseph is promptly forgotten, right? What was the one thing Joseph asked for? Yeah, remember me, kind of get me out of here, right? So why do you think he was forgotten? Why do you think he was forgotten?
Well, God's timing, yeah.
Yeah, okay, you guys are getting pretty sharp. You're getting a good answer there, yeah. Basically, that's the right answer. It wasn't God's timing, but why not? I mean, why not? What do you think?
Who are we to question God?
Betty, you have the best get-out-of-jail-free answers I've ever heard. You are really good. That's right. That's never wrong. But in this particular case, what is it? You know, what is it? What's that?
Pharaoh didn't have his dream for 2 years.
Well, yeah, he hadn't had the dream for 2 years. That's true as well. But again, let's go to Proverbs 16, okay? And again, I'm speculating, okay, so I'm trying to think through in my mind, why does he languish for another couple of years? A well-known passage, right, Proverbs 16 and verse 9 says this, "But the mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps," right? So if he had immediately gotten out, what trap could Jacob or Joseph have fallen into?
What?
Yeah, I got out by my own deal. Smart me. Didn't I look good for that, right? It's not in character with Joseph, right? Because before he interpreted the dreams, he attributed that to God, right? But for some reason, God felt he still needed more seasoning, right? So have you ever seen that, what are those, Cheez-Its? You ever seen the Cheez-Its ad? Ever seen it? Are you shaking your head? They got that wheel of cheese. It's the funniest ad I ever see. You know, it's cracking jokes, and the guy says, he's not ready yet. Send him back in there for some more aging, okay? So the fact of the matter is, I guess God felt that Joseph still needed some additional aging, if you will, learning to live in faith and trusting in him, and also being reminded, because remember, Joseph is very capable, right? I mean, he is singled out for his administrative gifts. So if you're administratively gifted, and that gets you to elevated positions, what is our natural tendency as human beings?
Pride,
right? You say, hey, man, I can do this, right? I've shared it several times. That was the thing that stood in the way, I'm sure, for me for years, which this idea was I didn't need help. Yeah, Jack.
And also the dreams are going to be eventually very important.
Yeah.
Pharaoh's
dream. Yeah.
And it was a dream about the baker, and the dream was no dream about Joseph either.
Mm. So. Yeah. Right. So you see that all together, and if you start to do that, and everything you plan works out, you become self-reliant, right? I mean, that really was. I wasn't antagonistic. It's just like, why? I'm doing fine. What would I need this for? So it's that idea. So I think possibly, you know, again, obviously God, for whatever reasons that God understood that we may not fully understand, Joseph still needed some seasoning. Now, as we get into 41, and as the cupbearer introduces Joseph to Pharaoh, one of the things he's going to say is he's a young pup. So it may be that he just needed to grow up some more, okay, age-wise, but whatever the reason was. So it's not to say that we shouldn't, yeah.
Sure. Telling his brothers and his father, you guys are going to bow down to me.
Right.
And that. So God knows his character. And
right.
Like, to your point, like you're saying, he probably figured he needs a little more,
yeah,
you know, like humbling.
A little more seasoning, a little more preparation. Because, look, he is going to get elevated to some heights of heights, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the temptation to abuse that is going to be as strong as it's going to be, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think so. So I say all that not to say that you don't think and plan, right? But I think you think and you plan and you hold it loosely, right? It's kind of the way I think about that. I do plan. I probably think and plan too much, right? But the fact of the matter is I hold it loosely. My wife is really laughing back there. You all can't see that. She's more than laughing. She's smirking. But the fact of the matter is that, yeah, you know, I think and I plan, and all I can say, as I've said to you before, I make weather forecasters look good, okay? I mean, their probabilities are way better than mine, so that tells you how poorly I think and plan sometimes. But the fact of the matter is, so as we begin the chapter, Joseph has languished now in prison for 2 years beyond the cupbearer's release, yet he is soon going to go from pining in prison, right, to posted in the palace, okay? Maybe I could say prancing in the palace, one of the two. But posted in the palace. And God will sovereignly promote Joseph to preserve both Egypt and subsequently his family, which is really the interest, right? So it's also interesting to see how God will preserve a many, right, for the few, right? So look at what he went through and all the people he did preserve. That's his common grace. But his specific or particular grace in that case is on the family in this particular area. So here's how the chapter lays out. The first 8 verses are the dream and the dilemma. Okay, dilemma simply being the lack of ability to interpret it. Then we see God's providential intervention in verses 9 to 13, followed by God's providential revelation in verses 14 to 36. Okay, now in 37 to 45, we see Joseph's promotion and his processional. And then finally, at the end, we see the years of plenty, Joseph's progeny, and the years of famine. So again, like a lot of Old Testament narrative, 45 verses kind of setting the whole thing up, and then 11 verses seeing it play out, right? Remember I told you a lot about Old Testament narrative is a lot of buildup, and then boom, a climax and a quick wind down. So we see kind of that played out here. Okay, Danae, I know you've been waiting for at least 6 weeks for this. So would you please read for us verses 1 through 8?
Now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile, there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they were grazed in the marsh grass. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them from the Nile, ugly and gaunt. And they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. The ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. He fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good, and whole. 7 ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. The thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Then Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now in the morning, his spirit was troubled. So he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt, and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh.
Okay, thank you. Everything is now right again in the world. All right, so Pharaoh's dreams. So after giving the time marker, verse 1 jumps right into the dream, okay? So in verses 2 to 8, we have the record of the dream. So let's just kind of start throwing out, what details about this dream do we see? What are some of the details about the dream? What do you see? Don't look at me, look at your Bibles.
He's near the Nile River.
Right, okay, so there, it's occurring there at the Nile River. So it's in Egypt, obviously. What else?
Reoccurring theme of the number 7.
Okay, yeah, we see the reoccurring theme of 7. Yeah, what else?
Double feature.
Double feature, yeah, I like that. Okay, it's a double feature, right? You get 2 for the price of 1. Yeah, okay, what else?
And the thin and gaunt eating up the fat and sleek.
Yeah, okay, right, another motif. What else? Yeah, we got that. She was here. Okay, so you guys got it. Number one, as Dave said, it's a double feature. Okay, there are 2 separate dreams, right? He awoke up between them. Okay, those similar plot lines for each one, right? Both dreams involve food groups, right? Meat and grain, right? So I had to look back. I was trying to see whether or not Egyptians actually ate meat, and they do. So I kind of poked around, so there was no issue there. So both sets of cows arise from the same place. So you mentioned that. So it's in the same setting. Both dreams have abnormal circumstances, right? Cows don't generally eat cows, right? Yeah. They generally eat grass, right? And we certainly, and the other kind of abnormal thing was that the east wind that came was a non-prevailing wind, okay? So in Scripture, an east wind is a dry, hot wind off the desert, but it often signifies judgment in the Old Testament, okay? So let's just look at a couple. Look at Hosea 13, that's the minor prophets, okay? That's the first of our minor prophets, right? HJA, Hosea, Joel, Amos. So Hosea chapter 13 and verse 15, we see an example of that. This is the worn out part of your Bibles, right? You're always back in the minor prophets. Okay, Hosea 13 and verse 15 says this, "Though he flourishes among the reeds, an east wind will come up, the wind of the Lord coming up from the wilderness, and his fountain will become dry, and his spring will become dried up. It will plunder his treasury of every precious article." Okay, so you see the east wind is a wind of judgment. In Jonah, you remember the last chapter, right? What happened in the last chapter? Jonah got all done. He went out, had a hot sun. What did God do? Raised up a tree for him to be under shade. What did he do to the tree? Whoosh! Brought an east wind and wiped it out. Okay, so you see that. And then Jeremiah is another passage you can take a look at, Jeremiah 18, 17. So another unusual or abnormal aspect of this is the east wind and it giving the blighted corn, which also then does the same thing as the cows do. And then the imagery of both dreams clearly startled Pharaoh, right? The first one caused him to wake up. Now, we've all had this happen, right? You're having a bad dream and you wake up, that happens. Then he goes back to sleep, and he woke up again and said, "And behold, it was a dream." I think he's kind of saying, "Oh, man, thank goodness, that was a dream." All right, but again, he sees that he had a troubled spirit. Okay, so we get a lot of facts about the dream. We get some details about it. The number 7 occurs in both dreams. In both dreams, abundance precedes want. Okay, in both dreams, the want consumes the abundance. In both dreams, the want is subsequent or sequential to the abundance, okay? So it says, has this little word after, which is a very specific Hebrew word. So this happened, and then after that, this happened. So we kind of see a sequence of events. So my question is, what other little fact about the dreams is also interesting? What's the other little fact about the dream in verse 8 that's interesting?
They couldn't be interpreted.
They couldn't be interpreted, okay? So Pharaoh's got access to the best and the brightest, but they were all stumped, over the dream. Okay? Now, why do I belabor the dream's details? Why do I belabor that, other than the fact that I'm kind of a weenie and I go through details? But other than that, why do I belabor the dream's details?
Because it's significant.
It's significant, right?
Well, it almost is in your, well, maybe, I mean, we're seeing it after the fact, but it's almost in your face clear.
Okay.
You know?
Betty, welcome back. You're hot today. This is great. Exactly
it's
right.
Puppy.
I don't think it is a particularly difficult dream to interpret. Okay, when you compare to the cupbearer and the baker's dreams, okay, this wasn't a particularly difficult dream, I think, to interpret. For instance, the dreams occurred in one place. You got that figured out. The numbers would indicate time periods because of this after marker, not quantities. And there's nothing particularly notable about seven cows. Now, 7 ears of corn on one stalk, that's pretty notable, so quantity could be at play there. But this after kind of says these are probably time periods. Okay, abundance and scarcity of food groups and changing supply conditions suggest feast and famine. I mean, feast and famine is not uncommon. There's not anything really uncommon about this process. And the repetition certainly indicates something unusual or momentous, okay, suggesting that the dream should be taken seriously, which indeed Pharaoh does. So what conclusion might we draw from all the interpreters being stumped?
God's hand.
God's hand, exactly right. God shut up their minds to understanding, okay? He shut their minds to understanding. So he providentially fills Pharaoh's mind with the dreams, and he blanked the minds of the magicians and the wise men. Now, why does he do that? Why does he blank their minds?
Joseph's time now.
Okay, you got it. It's time to wave the way for Joseph, right? Joseph is God's chosen instrument of revelation and deliverance, okay? So God is clearly orchestrating the events, okay? Remember, we've talked about God's providence when we went through the process. All right, somebody read verses. I thought I had something else there. Maybe that's a letter. Okay. Somebody read verses 9 to 13 for me.
Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servants, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. We had a dream on the same night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard. We related them to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream, and just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me in my office, but he hanged him.
Okay, so God did, however, open up the cupbearer's mind, bringing to mind the prison dream translator extraordinaire. Okay, so he finally remembers Joseph. Now, what does the cupbearer mean by, I would make mention of my offenses, literally sins, today in verse 9? What is he saying with that?
I think he just realized that he had forgotten about Joseph and didn't share him when he had the opportunity to do so.
That's right. Okay, I think that's down the right path. So he's not remembering his offenses or sins that got him incarcerated. He's bringing to mind. Now, the verb make mention actually literally translated means I am caused to remember. So it's a little more helpful when you can see kind of the more literal translation. So I think he is acknowledging his failure to remember Joseph, though I think he's probably more personally motivated by gain in solving Pharaoh's problem than he is genuinely repentant about forgetting Joseph. Okay, so I don't want to give the cupbearer too much credit here. He's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that kid. Oh yeah, hey, I can score a few points with Pharaoh if I remind him and I bring him to the process. Okay, so in other words, he's more driven by scoring points with Pharaoh than by genuine remorse over forgetting Joseph. Okay, but that's what started. Now, what does the cupbearer do in verses 10 to 13? What's he doing in that little monologue in 10 to 13? Right, but by recounting them, what else is he doing? Okay, so he is recounting what happened, okay, so he's kind of setting up the stage. But in doing that, what is he setting up?
Himself.
Okay, himself in what way? The cupbearer, you mean?
He's being truthful in what happened. He's relaying that to Pharaoh.
Right.
So Pharaoh will see that he's at least truthful.
Okay.
Therefore, Joseph, this young whippersnapper, it's a true story.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I think you're starting to get to the point here. I think it's something like this. He's certainly recounting his own personal experience. That's correct. So we see that. But the reason is why or what? What is he doing? First, I think what he's doing is preparing Pharaoh for what he's going to see. Okay? Now, Joseph is, first of all, a Hebrew. He highlights he's a Hebrew, so he's not an Egyptian. He secondly says what? He's a young pup, right? And thirdly, he's also saying that he does have some stature, even though he's in prison. Okay, so he's heading up the prison stuff. So he's, I think, preparing Pharaoh for what he's going to see. He's also probably covering his bases or covering his backside, right? Because he's effectively going to go ahead and recommend Joseph, right? So you're a nothing in front of a Pharaoh. If you kind of bring, first of all, an odd character in, and the odd character falls on his face, you want to be able to go back and say, well, I warned you. I told you he was a Hebrew. I told you he was this. I told you he was that. Okay, so I think there's some context in which he's preparing Pharaoh for that. Okay? So secondly, though, I think he is establishing Joseph's credibility. Right? So he ends this thing by saying, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. So we had these dreams. They were real. This kind of unlikely kid from the Hebrews interpreted it for us, okay? And by the way, his interpretation came true. Okay, so he's kind of setting up his bona fides or his credibility as a possible solution to his dilemma. All right?
He's making it a win-win. So if he fails, then oh, he's just a young kid. But if he's successful, see, I told you.
I told you. Wasn't that helpful to you, Pharaoh? Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of that going on. Remember, the cupbearer hasn't shown that he's regenerate or anything in the process. Okay, so somebody read verses 14 to 16. Audrey, you're smiling so lovely. You can read those for me. Come on, 14 to 16.
So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I heard of it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it.
Okay, so 14 to 16. Now,
did you get
16?
No.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so God's providential revelation of the dream, meaning, is going to proceed in four parts. Okay, there's going to be four parts to how this is going to play out. In part one, I'm going to suggest to you that what we're seeing is a job interview. Okay, he's going to have a job interview. In part two, in 17 to 24, Pharaoh recounts and adds to the dream. Okay, so obviously he passed the job interview, and he does go ahead and recount the dream to him. In part three, and verses 25 to 32, God's revelation to Joseph, or AKA the interpretation. We're going to see the interpretation that was revealed to Joseph. And then in part four, we're going to see God's directive to Pharaoh, okay, in verses 33 to 36. So four parts to how this whole providential revelation plays out in these verses. So in his desperation, Pharaoh summons Joseph with little regard for who or what he is, right? Cautioning us, I think, to remember a couple things. Number one, be mindful of who you're turning to in the midst of a crisis, all right? Don't just run to any little thing that you want to. And think carefully about your source of help. Okay, so he does turn to him. He's desperate. Joseph is smart enough, or the caretakers are smart enough to clean him up, all right? He's probably hairy and stinky at that point in time. And Egyptians were very clean, okay? So he had a shave and got dressed up, and he was presented to Pharaoh. Okay, and despite his desperation, I do think Pharaoh actually pauses here. Okay, starting in verse 15, briefly, ever so briefly, but he does pause before he goes. So what is going on? I've already given you the answer. First is a full disclosure. I think Pharaoh's actually being a little fair to Joseph right up front. He's saying, hey, look, I've had this dream, and nobody has been able to interpret it. So, you know, it's been a stumper, right? So are you really willing to step up and take this on? Okay, so some level of, you know, grace, I think, on Pharaoh's part in terms of what he's doing. But more so, I think Pharaoh is seeking validation from Joseph regarding his abilities, right? And willingness to accept the task. So thus, an interview of sorts, right? So I think he is kind of probing to validate what's been told and to see what Joseph himself says about his ability to interpret dreams, okay? So we see that happening. Now, what is interesting about Joseph's reply? Right.
He gives God all the credit for interpretation of dreams and doesn't, you know, give himself credit whatsoever, which is...
Yeah, absolutely, okay? There are a number of things that are interesting about the reply, but first we see the outworking of Proverbs 3:5, right? You know, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on his own understanding. So I think you see Joseph, you know, continuing to act out what he believes. But as Ray said, second, we see that Joseph never misses an opportunity to point to and glorify God, right? It's exactly what he did before, last time he interpreted, okay? And then thirdly, kind of akin to that, he never distorts the truth in any way for personal gain, right? He clearly could have said, oh yeah, Pharaoh, I am your man, okay? I'm going to get this right for you, dude, and it's going to get them all worked out. But he doesn't. He's humble. We see the humility. He points to God, okay, and he doesn't try to gain favor. He doesn't say, you know, well, I tell you what, I mean, I'll interpret this for you, but what's in it for me, right? You're going to send me back to prison? No, he just says, hey, look, the glory all goes to God, and that's what's going to happen. So I think it kind of reminds us of an important thing, and that is guarding God's honor and glory should really supersede our desire for personal gain, right? It's not always easy to do, right? But honor and his glory really needs to be our primary interest. What's the Westminster Shorter Catechism say? Chief end of man is what? Glorify God and enjoy him forever. But yeah, again, glorify God. You know, it is funny. I've talked about it a couple times before. You know, we have these four kind of points of ministry philosophy, right? So what's our four points? We what?
Exalt God.
Exposit the scriptures. What's that? Equip the saints. Evangelize the lost. Okay, so three out of four, not bad. You know, we got to pick up that evangelizing the lost part. I think we got to get a little better at that. But really, I always, whenever I hear somebody say on a church website, well, we make it our aim to exalt God. You know, I feel like it's like one of those throwaway lines, right? Well, yeah, doesn't everybody exalt God? But really, when you stop and think about that, and you really genuinely think about it, you know, what is it that means to exalt God? Well, I think the simple way to think of it is you're having a high view of God, but what else? A correspondingly low view of man, okay? So really exalting God is indeed the whole thing. I almost think of the next three as the methods or means that we have had up put on our heart to do that, right? By we exalt him by expositing the scriptures. Now, I'm not saying we do that any better or worse than anybody else, but I'm saying however well we do it or don't do it, the focus of what we do in the pulpit event and other things is, in fact, the scriptures, all right? Secondly, what we're doing is equipping you all to do the work. So here you thought we were doing the work, right? No, we don't do anything. We equip you guys to do the work. But really, when you think about that, and teasing aside, that is what makes a church work, right? I mean, when you're relying on paid staff, definitionally, you will never have enough paid staff, any church of any size, to do that. And it also creates the wrong idea. Katie has said many times, I think she's absolutely right, the thing that has killed the church is the mega church movement. Because what it did was professionalize, quote, quote, the ministry. And basically the message it sent was, don't try this. This is only for the suits, right? Or the guys with the collars, right? You can't possibly do that. Well, no, that's exactly the opposite, I think, of the way the church is intended to work. I mean, the church is the ultimate volunteer organization. And when you think about it, if the whole church isn't pulling, you know, why do we get so much from Paul in 1 Corinthians, right? You got noses and ears and eyes and feet and, you know, glamorous parts and less glamorous parts, but none of it works unless all those parts are pulling together to do what it needs to do. So I think there's kind of really an important thing. So guarding God's honor and glory really should supersede our gain, our desire for personal gain. And I think Joseph really models it very well. Okay? Now, fourth, I think that Joseph is indirectly asking Pharaoh if he wants to proceed. Okay? It's kind of like the idea, the English versions obscure it with the translation that says that he will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Okay? Now, who wouldn't want a favorable answer, right? What it really says in the Hebrew is a complete or full answer, okay? He says, you know, God will give you a complete and full answer. So the idea is that God is going to give you everything, and the implied question hanging in the air is, he's not going to hold anything back. Do you really want to know? Okay, so there's just, I think there's a lot of subtlety. I think a Hebrew natural speaker would have picked up on it. It's harder for us as native English speakers. But I think that there is really something here, just in these few short verses and a few short exchanges of what Pharaoh's doing and how Joseph is responding to him. Yeah, Roger.
My version says answer of peace.
Yeah, answer of peace, right. The word is shalom. Okay, so peace, fullness, completion. Yeah, an answer of peace, right. But again, it still even implies, you know, they say shalom, peace, you know, like it's going to be a good outcome. What Joseph is saying, I think, is, hey, I'm not going to promise you good or bad. I'm just going to promise you that I'm going to tell you. Like, kind of reminds me of, you're in 1 Samuel at this point, right? We got past the part where little Samuel has to go tell Eli that he's about to die and his kids are going to die. Don't hold anything back from me, son. Tell me everything the Lord told you. Right? So, yeah, he's going to tell him everything the Lord told him. In that case, it wasn't such a great message. Right? In other cases, it's going to work out. All right, 17 to 24. Somebody read those for me, please.
So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph. In my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile. Behold, seven cows, fat and sick, came up out of the Nile, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Lo, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such as I had never seen ugliness in all the land of Egypt. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, but they were just as ugly as before. Then I awoke. I saw also in my dream, behold, seven ears full of good came up on a single stalk, and lo, seven ears withered thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them, and the thin ears swallowed the seven good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me.
Okay, so no one could explain it to me. Now, what does verse 17 indicate by him starting to relate the dream?
You're hired.
You're hired. Got it. Okay, Betty is still on the game today. You're right. He got the job, right? He got the job. So he started telling him the dream. All right, anything materially different about the dreams in verses 18 to 24?
He puts himself in the dream.
He puts himself in the dream.
Like, in other words, he says, I was standing by the Nile where, I don't know, before it was just like he saw it more as an outsider rather than being in it.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I hadn't seen that. You're right. He does do that. That's a good point. He kind of in that jack.
Does he add the fact that
yeah, okay, so he certainly added some embellishments in this that we didn't get before in 19b and 21. So the gaunt cows, like Pharaoh had never seen before, okay, so he just said gaunt cows before. He's really kind of stressing that these were some ugly cows, okay, some skinny bony cows, and there was no fattening them up, okay, so even when they ate them, their condition didn't change. So I think we get a little sense of kind of what Pharaoh seems to emphasize is what he doesn't understand about the dream. So maybe he kind of understood the dream, but he just didn't understand how it was going to work itself out. So he concludes by reinforcing that these dreams have heretofore defied interpretation. So again, not much here, just recounting the dreams, indicating that he's given the job to Joseph. He's waiting for the interpretation. He's provided some more embellishment that kind of maybe gives us a sense of why he's alarmed to the degree that he is alarmed about these dreams. And then again, he emphasizes again, heretofore, defied interpretation. So maybe he's given Joseph one last chance to bow out and say, you know what, I got to tell you, Pharaoh, you're right. These do defy interpretation. But indeed, he does that. Okay? Verses 25 to 32.
Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind will be 7 years of mourning. It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. And after them, 7 years of famine will come. And all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. And the famine will ravage the land. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of that subsequent famine. For it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about.
Okay, so what's Joseph doing in verse 25? What is he doing? Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams were one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. What is he doing? What is he announcing with that statement?
God worked through Pharaoh's dreams to give him a message.
Yeah. What's he saying about God?
Once again, it's not me.
Right, it's not me. Yeah. But what's he saying about God? He's asserting God's sovereignty over Pharaoh. Okay? Now that is a big deal. Okay? It's both risky and astounding, as the pharaohs thought themselves to and were worshipped as gods. So the pharaohs were considered to be, quote, quote, little g, God, okay? So he basically starts out by asserting God's sovereignty over Pharaoh. So he doesn't pull any punches, okay? And he takes some personal risk in the process. So by accepting Joseph's interpretation, Pharaoh is also tacitly subordinating himself to the God. Okay, so there's a lot going on in that kind of little statement. So reminding us of the first commandment that there shall be no other gods beside me. So God never misses a chance to remind us of that when it is appropriate, which is probably more often than we would like it to be appropriate. Okay, now what aspect of God's will is demonstrated in verses 26 to 36? Remember we talked, said there were two parts of God's will. There's God's decretive will, and then this is kind of his revealed or preceptive will. Which of these two wills are we seeing here? You got a 50-50 chance. You might as well just take a stab at it. Huh?
Preceptive.
Preceptive, okay. Anybody want to go for a decretive?
Yeah, decretive. He's revealing it.
Yeah, okay. So it's a little of both. It's not quite the extensiveness of, you know, decretive will is unrevealed. But he is revealing, right, his unrevealed will. So you can almost say it's prophetic, all right? It's not a perfect question, but basically he is revealing what's going to happen over the next 14 years. Okay, so he's telling him what is going to happen. Now, we'd like to know that sometimes, wouldn't we? Maybe. I mean, at my age, I'm not sure I want to know about the next 14 years because it might be done. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, he is giving him that scenario. So 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of famine. The interpretation is first that Joseph reveals that the two dreams are one. So as David said, a double feature. Okay, so it's one dream. And as we get to the end of that, why we're told why he gets it twice, right? And what's that? To assure that it's going to happen. Okay, he ain't going to get out of this. Next, he reveals the duration of them, right? 14 years, seven good calves and seven good ears represent the initial seven-year period. After that, we have the seven gaunt and the seven withered, okay? In verse 28, Joseph pauses to reaffirm God's sovereignty again, okay? So again, he never misses a chance. What's he do? It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Pharaoh, okay, do not be confused, okay? God is going to do this, and that's what's going to happen. And then he goes on and gives more detail, right? So he's intent that Pharaoh understand who's in charge and that these are God's words, right? It's kind of like the prophet that says, thus saith the Lord. You better be thus saying the Lord or you're going to be in a heap of trouble, you know, as a false prophet in the process. Now, one of the tests of prophetic words was what? Do they come true, right? And so now we're going to see that coming true. Okay, next we're told that there will be abundant meat and grain for the first 7 years called great plenty. So really a bounty harvest those 7 years, followed by a severe famine that's going to consume it all. So the plenty is going to be above normal, and the famine is going to be above normal in terms of its, you know, its intensity in both of those sides. Joseph closes by explaining that the dream's repetition, again, confirms the certainty of their fulfillment, and I think also the imminence, okay? This is what God's going to do. Not at some point in time, not some point in time in the future. God's going to do it, and he's going to do it now. Okay? So kind of a strong thing. We'll close up with these three verses today. Somebody read 33 to 36.
And now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact the fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that they are coming, and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. And let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during the famine.
Okay, so what is going on in these last four verses? What's going on?
Preparation.
Okay. Yeah.
He's demonstrating. Apparently, Pharaoh is accepting the fact that God is going to do this.
Right. Okay. So I like the idea of preparation and accepted. First, what it's not. It's not. Oh, Jack, go ahead.
I might be reading too much into it, but Joseph's got the floor now.
Right.
Throws in there a solution that Pharaoh's own people probably would have come up with on their own.
Well, yeah, I think you're getting down the right path. It's a bonus round for sure, okay? He is proposing a solution. That's exactly what he's doing, okay? Right? But it's not part of the dream interpretation, right? He was just brought in to interpret the dream. So at a minimum, it's presumptuous if it's not risky in the process, okay? So yeah, I think that's kind of the right idea. Rather, it's a bonus round, an epilogue that I've called God's directive, okay? Now, why do I label this God's directive? Why do I call it God's directive? It's God's revelation. Why do I call it God's directive?
Joseph is in prophet mode right now.
Uh-huh.
So he's speaking, God is speaking. Through him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. I mean, Joseph would never have taken this initiative on his own. There's no way in the protocol of the Pharaoh's court that you would have gone beyond what you were called to do. He's basically, remember, the Hebrew pup, right, that was no more than a guy that headed up some prisoners, and now he's telling those powerful guy in the land what to do, okay? So there's no way. So he's highlighting this, I think, that he's not self-serving, and it's to highlight he's not self-serving, okay, with a suggestion conjured up for his benefit, but he is still, I think, as Betty noted, he's speaking under inspiration still. I mean, he's still speaking. Yeah, Bobby.
Let's back up a little bit.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the one who lived and didn't say anything for 2 years.
Right.
When he got out of jail, who was he going to tell anyway?
Sure.
And he was just happy to get out of jail and to not be dead like the other
Yeah, right.
So that might have been God doing that too, because who was he going to tell until somebody asked him?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right. I mean, it is all under God's control. It's not like he would go out and say, oh, Pharaoh, thanks, I'm back. Hey, could you help my buddy out?
Yeah.
Right? You know, no, I'm going to throw you right back in the clan right after that. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, but clearly he could have maybe told somebody that could have told Pharaoh or somebody else or somebody else. I mean, you know, even though you don't do these things, there is a way in the court to get the word to the man. And but, yeah, I think there's certainly that. And, again, all part of God's providential plan. He didn't want it to be revealed at that point in time. Okay, so he is still speaking under inspiration. He wouldn't have done this on his own. And it isn't, I think, also, we should know, a self-serving attempt on his part to set up a deal, which, in fact, Pharaoh is going to affirm in verse 39. Okay, he's going to say in verse 39, he says this. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there's no one so discerning as wise as you are. Okay, so, you know, Pharaoh affirms that this isn't him just seeking to get some favor. So what is verse 36, 33 and 36 all about? It's God's revealed and divine directions for dealing with this period of famine, feast and famine. Okay, so not only did God reveal to Pharaoh what was going to happen, he told Pharaoh how to handle it. Yeah, now whether they would have come up with it on their own, I'm not sure. Because what do? When we hear something like that, and if the feast comes first, right? We feast, right? We feast, we spend. Ah, come on. I mean, great plenty. How can this be true, right? So obviously he does in that regard. So not only does Pharaoh receive God's interpretation, but God tells him how to govern through the crisis. Now, what are the details of the solution? I'll just run through them quick because we're running out of time. First, select a discerning and wise overall administrator. Okay, so select somebody that will administer this program in a wise and discerning way. And we're going to see, when we get to it next week, how Joseph indeed does that in a wise and concerning way. He implements a 20% tax, right? Okay, so take 20% in the years of plenty and store it away, right? Because what is our natural tendency?
Spend
it all, right? So he says put it away. Establish warehouses to store the taxed excess, right, which will be reserved for the lean years, so that the land, really people, will not perish. So he gives them the purpose for the process. Now, what is God ultimately doing by providing all these details? What's he ultimately doing by providing all these details? I've forgotten the answer, too. So if you're perplexed, I'm perplexed.
To preserve Jacob's family.
Yeah, okay, good.
Paving the way for Joseph to be the man.
There you go. Leading the way for Pharaoh to do the obvious and pick the obvious overall administrator. Okay. So he's leading Pharaoh to Joseph by Joseph being the mouthpiece. Now, whether Pharaoh would have understood that this was God speaking through Joseph or not is unclear, but he had what he considered was a reasonable interpretation. And then when Joseph takes the initiative, at least from Pharaoh's perspective, to give him a reasonable solution to dealing with it, you know, it kind of leads Pharaoh to the obvious conclusion in terms of what he might do. Okay?
But so this also solidifies all of Joseph's dreams in his younger years that he told to his brother.
Exactly right. Okay? So as we go through it next week and we begin to see the outworking of that, you then connect it all the way back to verse 37, which was, you know, remember Jacob kind of chastised Joseph, but he kind of was thinking, hey, this kid might be thinking something because things had happened to him in dreams that had come true.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to begin to see that he's setting up, obviously, the fulfillment of what he said he was going to do at that period.